Have you ever had a feeling that something dreadful was about to happen?
This whole premise is sweaty.
Okay, moving right along.
You gonna plagiarize the whole thing for us? Do you have any thoughts of your own on this matter?
Just remember that this thing isn't as black as it appears.
Hold on to your butt.
The only difference between me and a homeless man is his job.
I'm glad you're here to tell us.
I'm looking for the least possible amount of responsibility.
And that ain't bad.
I'm in a glass case of emotion.
Man's got to know his limitations.
I'm glad you came back.
In the bag!
Network. I drink it up!
Welcome to the Bag Pod, everyone. The glorious return of Mr. Templin on today's podcast.
Hello. What's going on? Hi. I didn't think you would invite me back.
Well, I mean, you know, you sort of class up the joint a little bit.
I class up the joint?
Yeah, we get a
little... What are you, my mother?
Yep, pretty much. You're a handsome young man, Will.
Mm.
The world is your oyster.
Mm-hmm.
Last time we talked about the Oscars and the bogusness of them and your top movies, even though you don't like lists. So, you know, you offer a very distinct viewpoint that most other people do not offer up. So
yes, my opinions are right.
Sure. Sure.
I'm just kidding on that one. No, I would admit it's distinct.
Yes. I also feel as though we can talk about something a little more, something. Maybe not deeper, but something that's not movie-specific more than any of the other contributors on the website, if you will. So, with your fountains of old film knowledge and your degrees.
My 2 degrees.
Yes, all those sweet, sweet degrees. So
that are going to wonderful use right now.
Hey, my degree is basically just sitting in a box somewhere. But
is it a big box?
No, it's not. In fact, I had to look for it the other day because I thought I needed
it. Does it come with a fridge?
Unfortunately not. In any case, enough about degrees. Last week, you and I both wrote reviews on John Carter, the latest.
Well, you wrote the review. I wrote
the quick
impression. I couldn't stand writing about it anymore review kind of thing.
Yeah, the 200-word review, basically just you saying I hated it. I understand why you hate it. You don't like many things.
I like things.
I tried to remain positive throughout my review, but I don't know if I liked it. I wanted to like it, but it definitely has some severe flaws, so.
Some?
Well, yes. Most severe flaws? I don't know.
Well,
with flaws?
After reading your review and after talking to a bunch of people who saw it, I got the impression that people were going, it was okay. It was mediocre.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that made me cringe because nothing about this movie, there's nothing redeeming about it.
Mm-hmm.
And as filmmakers or people that have seen lots of movies, you shouldn't be having, I think, that attitude. You should be calling out this monstrosity for what it is. And you should, you know, I don't know. That's my take on it. And so when I see like you and other people I know and friends that are just, they're giving it these lukewarm reviews, that encourages me to, that encourages my wrath.
Yeah.
Rather than the movie itself.
The wrath of Will is brought down upon.
Yes.
Us.
Yes. So go ahead. I mean, go ahead and explain why you liked it and why you didn't like it first.
Well, the thing with it for me was that it wasn't, I mean, it was, like you said, I thought it was mediocre. I mean, it was just like the middle-of-the-road blockbuster/popcorn movie, you know? It wasn't worse than most, and it wasn't, clearly it wasn't better than most. So, I mean, I thought, you know, the main problems, I mean, in most of my reviews, I usually talk about story and structure and that sort of stuff. And that's
and this one, yeah, this one was completely missing, so
yeah,
you couldn't talk about that. Yeah.
That's usually my focus in most reviews. And, yeah, like I said, I think I said in my review, it was kind of just like careening between scenes and scenes without very much character development, really. But I feel as though that the real shortcoming of the movie is maybe their strict adherence to the book. I haven't read the book, but it seems like they wanted to include as much of the book as humanly possible into the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And usually that ends up being a not so good idea. Like, I feel as though there were actually two stories within this movie, one of which is John Carter's sort of self, you know, becoming aware of himself and, like, deciding to take up a cause or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's, like, the first half. And then the second half is what happens when he does.
Mm-hmm.
But because everything's so condensed and everything's, like, kind of just pushed up together, we really just kind of get the basic plot points, and we don't actually get to see John Carter really grow or anything.
Honestly, I find this is very consistent among adaptations nowadays. People are taking a book or a comic book, and these screenwriters and these filmmakers are, they feel that they need to do every scene, they need to do every plot point, they need to introduce every single character.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that is you're working with two different mediums. You're working with either a book or a novelization or a comic book, and you're working with film. And film is visual.
Yes.
And the other one is not.
Yes.
And so you have to adapt the source to fit the new medium. And I think the problem is, and you look at a lot of these pictures, the girl with the dragon tattoo, the Help. This one, these screenwriters are getting lazy, and they're just doing scene for scene, character for character, plot point for plot point, plot point for plot point, and it doesn't work as a movie. It's not flowing.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem like it's growing organically and naturally. And, you know, a real screenwriter, one that's not lazy,
mm-hmm.
looks at the whole of the original work, understand what the main idea and what the main thrust and focus of that original work is.
And then adapt.
And then they adapt.
Yeah.
So sometimes, honestly, do you need some characters? No. One, for instance, I always bring up the Gone with the Wind. Gone with the Wind, Scarlett has multiple children in the book. But in the movie, she has one.
Mm-hmm.
And you only need one because one is symbolic and it lives and it dies. And that's kind of a symbol for the relationship between Scarlett and Brett. And you don't need multiple kids because multiple kids, it brings so much into it and you can't concentrate, you can't focus on one individual
mm-hmm.
or one symbol. And so we forget that films are about symbols and reading into things and this means this and our preconceived notions of what these ideas are affected very much with movies. And so I find that adaptations now are trying to please the original audience. Harry
yes.
Potter is another one.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that you're getting these very slow, inconsistent hodgepodge of scenes that don't work organically.
Yeah. Jake and I... another In the Bag contributor, we're talking about the recent comic book movies and their adaptations. And I would definitely say that it's, I don't know if it's become harder, but it seems as though the screenwriters definitely are trying and need to play up to the hardcore fan base of their material. Because they know, I mean, they also realize that they need to bring in new viewers, but if the hardcore fans of the original material don't come in, that usually they hear it, you know, they hear like an earful from them and it usually ends up, hindering, the success of the movie.
Well, honestly, the hardcore fans are going to come out the first weekend anyway.
Yeah.
And if they start rattling their sabers because this certain scene is not there or this character is not there, I could care less if I was writing something, because I was just reminded, I watched the best of this Triumph the Comic Dog the other day,
mm-hmm.
and there's a scene where he's going around interviewing all these Star Wars fans while they wait for Attack of the Clones.
Uh-huh.
And these are the hardcore fans. These are the ones that are dressing up like Yoda and Jedi.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're acting out scenes from the movie while they're waiting in line.
For 5 or 6
They're playing Stratego and Risk.
Yeah.
Honestly, I wouldn't care if they started yelling at me because I forgot or I left out or I changed the motivation of a character.
Well, I'm not saying that it's right to do, but I'm saying it feels like, for some odd reason, they either feel more pressure to do the fans the service that they think they need, or they're just, I mean, I don't know why it's happened this way, but it does, I mean, I think you'd agree that it does seem like, especially in comic book movies, most of the movies are really playing towards the hardcore fans much more than one would think.
Well, honestly, I think a lot of these screenwriters and a lot of these filmmakers are fanboys themselves,
mm-hmm.
and they're not taking themselves away from their love of the original source and material, and they're not taking an objective view on it. And that's why, for instance, I loved the Tim Burton Batman film, because Tim Burton admitted that he wasn't a Batman fan. He never read the comic books. He brought an objective viewpoint into making that movie, and I think it works, because he's looking at the characters, he's looking at the relationships of those characters. He's bringing his ideas of production design and costumes, and it works.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was great. And Tim Burton, he's a dark character himself, but he doesn't like Batman. He never read Batman, and that's good. Whereas Christopher Nolan, for instance, he is a total fanboy, and he loves these comic books and the source material that he's drawing from. And for me, these new Batman movies are not working.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's what I think on that.
Okay. I mean, I don't know. John Carter, to get back to the topic at hand, if you will, John Carter, I mean, I wanted to like it. It just, like, I think my opening line was that it was almost good.
See, that made me cringe. That made me really hate you that second there, Chris.
Yeah, why is that?
Because it wasn't even close to working.
Well, I don't know. I mean, my entire thesis was basically that there were these two movies in there, and I think both of them could have been fairly good. But
well, for me, it was Outlaw Josie Wales meets Dune.
Mm-hmm.
And if I was a screenwriter, I was given this premise. This would be a head scratcher, and then B, as an, you know, coming from an audience perspective, you're given two exotic worlds, because this Mars, I don't know what Mars is like. I don't know who these characters are and their language and their relationships and their politics.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, a lot of audience members are not really familiar with the Civil War era. That, in a sense, is an exotic era itself.
That's true.
There's at the beginning, I could sense it was going to be awful, because they start with Mars for five minutes,
yeah.
And then they go to the Civil War, and they go back to Mars, and you have this jumping from place to place, and as an audience member, you have no sense of the atmosphere, you have no sense of history, you have no sense of the people, their motivations or anything, and it's very superficial again, and it's very tough. And as a screenwriter, if I was presented with that problem, I would have just at least established the era that John Carter is coming from first,
mm-hmm.
and taken time and develop his character within that era. And you only see it for maybe what, 5 minutes, where he gets captured and then he escapes.
Yeah, I mean, I want to say, like, the first half an hour of the movie is almost John Carter-less. almost. Like, the focus in the first 30 minutes is definitely more focused on Mars and, like, trying to set up what the hell's going on in Mars. And, I mean, we get the fact that John Carter is a bit of a scamp, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, we don't really get anything besides him looking for this gold.
Yeah, I mean, as an audience, we're a little bit more familiar with the American Civil War than we are with the politics of Mars.
Yes.
So I would have started with the Civil War. You could have taken some liberties there. Or it's actually post-Civil War, Reconstruction.
Yeah.
So I would have taken a little more liberty there. But then that's where you as a screenwriter are trying to identify yourself, the audience, with the main character, because it should be us going with the character and discovering this new planet through him.
Mm-hmm.
We shouldn't have had that intro to Mars before. That didn't make any sense at all. We need to be like him, questioning what we're seeing and what we're presented. And all these relationships and characters should just flow naturally for him and us at the same time.
Yeah.
I never felt that at all.
I mean, I would definitely agree, and that's why. I mean, that's just one of the instances why I feel as though they were strictly adhering to the book as opposed to making it more, making it flow better on screen and making it seem as though, you know, what you just described. That because it definitely felt like that first 5 minutes was completely just like book prologue, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Not, like I said, I haven't read the book, but it seems like that's what it was. So,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. In any case.
And then on top of all that,
yeah.
You had horrible acting.
Yeah, the acting.
On top of all that, you had really bad CGI. on top of all that, well, it can go on and on and on. So I didn't think there was one redeeming quality about this movie. And kind of makes you wonder why, what gave it the green light to begin with, what gave it the green light for $250 million to make it,
mm-hmm.
And it boggles your mind, and as someone who likes film, who makes films,
mm-hmm.
It's very disturbing that this can be made, but a small pet project that maybe would take them a couple of million would never be able to get made, and I don't know. It's disheartening at times.
Yeah.
But that's.
But it gives you dreams, Will.
It gives me dreams.
You can dream to make a shitty $250 million movie.
Yes, I can. But that would be a nightmare, I guess. It wouldn't be a dream.
Well, I mean, getting to the point where someone is giving you $250 million to make a movie is, I would have to say, is a bit of a dream.
Oh, it's never going to happen. Don't get me wrong. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, no, but I'm just saying that
can't they
part,
spare
that
maybe,
part
can't they spare
good.
Maybe like, you know, a couple hundred thousand? Just a little bit?
No, they can't do that.
Just a little bit. Spread the risk out.
Well, you need to just befriend some really rich people out in L.A. and then hire me as something on your movie. That's what we really need.
Okay, I'll do that.
Good. In any case, yeah, John Carter. Yeah.
Well, this goes into the whole idea that film is really wrapped up with bucks and money,
mm-hmm.
and making a bottom line that is huge, and it's all about investment and making sure that there's profit for all those investors. And
very true.
Honestly, that's. It is what it is. I think it's wrong. You know, it's not like the old days where some royalty commission, royal person commissioned an artist to draw or paint a picture, and they just hung it up in their house. Can't do that anymore. Now we have to try to make money on any commissioned artwork, and that's very disturbing.
Well, I mean, film in itself, I would have to say, is a interesting media because, I mean, for the most part, I'd say audiences do not go to watch a film like the reason why we would go. Like, film is a very much an escapist sort of thing, whereas art I mean, at least now, I don't know if back in like the 1700s it was viewed differently.
Mm-hmm.
But now art is more of like a scholarly debate as opposed to, you know, just going and being able to lose yourself in it.
Honestly, like I was at the museum the other day and I was looking at all the furniture they had, this really Rococo Baroque style furniture strewn about the rooms. And I was thinking this was actually used as real furniture for rich people back then.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't considered, you know, a great piece of artwork. It was just artwork in someone's house,
and they used to sit on it.
They used to open the drawers and put their panties in there, or who knows what.
Their pantaloons.
Yeah. And so you are correct in the sense that there's this with time things are given the sense of aura and movements are come up with, and different artists are exposed for being better than others. I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I think art and creativity is the most, it's one of the best expressions of being a human being there is.
Yes.
Because there's so much involved. It's intellectual, it's emotional, there's utility. And when one of those is missing, I think it's wrong. Because human beings are very complicated creatures. We're these animals that have these animalistic instincts and emotions, irrational emotions. But at the same time, we're given a brain that we can use logic and we have intellectual curiosity.
Yes.
And I'm finding a lot of supposed art and creations are missing this intellectual curiosity or logic to them, and it's all just based on thrills, spectacle,
yeah,
trying to pump up your adrenaline, playing with your emotions. And I think that is wrong. I mean, if you want to do that, just go on a roller coaster ride at Six Flags.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the medium of film in general, I would say, is more clearly geared more towards entertainment than I think, you know, music would be or anything else.
Well, what does it mean to be entertained?
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I don't know. I mean,
I find, for instance, Melancholia very entertaining, but at a different level than, let's say, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I would have to say you're probably finding Melancholia entertaining. For 95% of the average Joe population, if you will, maybe not the people that care about film as much as we do, they probably would not find that entertaining, whereas Raiders of the Lost Ark clearly is focused on the spectacle and the escapism and getting to enjoy yourself while you're watching the movie, as opposed to, you know, having to dissect characters and themes and stuff.
Well, and honestly, it's always been like that with the majority of people. But there is this in this country, there is this sense of I don't care, I don't want to find out, I'm not curious. There's this anti-intellectualism and this laziness. I find that people don't want to do research. People don't want to look at things in a different way. They don't want to dissect ideas that are presented. And I find that's a very dangerous atmosphere that's being created, especially with technology growing as much as it is.
Mm-hmm.
And this fetish with screens and movies, because movies can be used very easily in advertising for propaganda purposes.
Very true.
And if you have the majority of people that don't question what they're seeing, then I think there's a real big problem. And not only are they not questioning it, but they don't really want to question what they're seeing. And I think that's very disturbing. Especially now.
Well, I mean,
the times we're living in.
I think that is just part of the film medium in itself, is that people go so that they necessarily don't have to think.
But like, that's not true. Even John Carter, there's, you know, in that movie, there's some sort of, even though it's minuscule, logic to how the scenes are trying to progress and how the characters are trying to interact. People always say, I go to movies because I don't want to think. Well, you honestly are thinking in the movie.
Well, I'm aware that you're thinking, but basically what I'm saying is people don't want to make it seem like they have to think about it. You know what I'm saying?
Well, okay, so we just want to be zombies?
Clearly for me, I don't go into a movie being like, yes, I can turn my brain off and just let the amazing colorful tones wash over me. But, I mean, I would say, I mean, why else do you think, you know, movies like Transformers and that sort of stuff are so popular? It's not because people are going in and dissecting, like, how, like, the Transformers I don't even know. I can't even make anything up right now for Transformers.
Well, it just goes back to, you know, why is McDonald's so popular? Because it's cheap. It's instant gratification. Is it good for you? No. But that's the culture we're living in, and we're living in and that's why I think it's so wrong right now. We're getting all these brands bombarding us, and no one's questioning what the brand is. No one's questioning what they're eating, what they're watching, mm-hmm. what they're feeling, and I think that's a big problem. And so it's easy to say, well, you know, we movies are for escape. Well, McDonald's is there, you know, for easy instant gratification. But the long-term consequences of this, if all you're given is McDonald's, all you're given is Transformers 3, what is that creating for a culture? If those are the only choices you're given, well, maybe you might, you know, be able to pick between McDonald's and Burger King.
Yeah.
But if those are the only choices you're given, then that's limiting choice, and that's limiting expression, that's limiting freedom, and you are no longer a unique individual. You are now just part of a demographic. And you're not unique, and it's very disturbing.
I mean, I agree with you. I'm not trying to say that. I'm not trying to disagree at all. Like I agree with what you're saying.
I know you agree. Yeah. And I feel, Chris, that, you know, you are in a position to, you know, you've been schooled, you know movies, you should be as mad as me when it comes to this and be a little bit more radical, because to just accept the status quo for what it is, you're just prolonging the problem, making it worse rather than trying to do something about it.
I mean, I see what you're saying here. Clearly that to change something so drastically to what you would like to see it is,
not necessarily what I would like to see.
I'm using the universal you here. Mm-hmm. You know, that's everyone's, or that should be everyone's, at least one of someone's dreams at one point or another, is to change the world somehow in a more positive light, or at least a light that you think would be more positive.
No, it's not. It's not about me changing the world or you changing the world. It's about just opening up people's minds to ideas and new perspectives so that they feel that they are important and that they can change. And when it all starts individually, if people start reacting and they don't like what they're giving, and it's you, me, and everyone we know, and then everyone they know, it just, it continues, and we don't accept what we're given from up above. And the market listens, and it's not like they're doing this on purpose. McDonald's is not trying to be evil and kill you on purpose with diabetes and high blood pressure. They're not trying to do that. They're just feeding in the market. And so if the market rejects what they're given, then they change. And you already see it that McDonald's, they introduce salads, mm-hmm. or they introduce the healthy choice.
The problem with that is
they're, you know, they quote healthy choice. They've now started changing what healthy means. And they still cover the salad in ranch, And yeah. ranch is not healthy. And so I've seen a box actually from McDonald's recently, and on the side of the box they're going it's full of whole grains and fresh farm grown chicken or tomatoes or lettuce.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting how they are changing words, and no one's questioning that at all. But at the same time, they are reacting to a market that's saying, no, we want to be healthy. They're using that and making it fit them a little bit easier.
Well, I mean,
but if you have a true market that says, I don't want this, I don't even want the salad with the ranch, then they are going to change. They will change. You see it in Walmart, too. They started carrying organic products.
Yeah.
You know, if the market changes, they will change. And the market starts with individuals. And individuals need to start getting radical. And not accept the status quo for what it is.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying. And it's not just food. It's everything. And film is just one of those things that is just representative of where we are as a culture. And it's very disheartening.
I mean, I would tend to agree with you, but I also, when I'm writing a review, I also have to take into consideration not how much better it could be in the future, but what we're working with now.
Yep, and then therefore you shouldn't say it's almost good. You should say it's terrible.
Comparatively to...
No, don't compare it to anything. You just look at a piece of work for what it is right there and then. You can't really get into this comparing, contrasting from other films from genres because, again, genres and types, those are just marketing terms. A Western is a marketing term. You know, a musical is a marketing term. It's an idea to try to get people into the theater. So you can't compare and contrast movies because, again, you're playing into a marketing scheme.
All right. You say so, Will.
I say so. I mean, why would you disagree with that?
Ultimately, a review is a compare and contrast. You have to compare it to something.
Why?
Well, you're comparing it to at least your values and what you think is good.
Mm-hmm. And then you need to start questioning your values as well. What determines your values? What determines your taste? Are you just being told what your values and your taste are from marketing or from your parents? Where do they learn it from? You know, that's the importance of these reviews. It should be a reflection of not only the film, but of you as an individual. And you should be questioning everything. And that's the whole idea of critical thinking. Critical thinking is this idea of having a curiosity of asking the tough questions, like why are we being presented this? Mm-hmm. What is this that I'm given? And we need to start looking at films not just as a film, but as a piece of culture and a representation of that culture. I don't know. Do you agree or disagree with something like that?
I mean. I agree to a certain extent. Clearly answering the question of why is probably the most important question of all regarding anything.
The thing is with reviews, and I notice a lot of the talking heads that you find on TV nowadays, especially on like Fox News and CNN. Mm-hmm. It's all black and white for them. They have the answers, yes and no. And I think we, again, we're living in such a world of gray that when you write a review, you should not necessarily have an answer, but you should at least presenting the question. So the question will make people think and give them a new perspective or a new idea on something. And so to say a film is good or bad, I think is wrong to give it like a rating, 4 out of 4 stars or whatever. I think that's wrong. Mm-hmm. you know, I work in the wine business, and I see all these ratings all the time on the wines. You know, they gave it 91 points, Wine Spectator, 92 points, And people come in and buy product based on those
ratings.
Points.
Yeah.
And I find that very troubling because points are so subjective. What's the most important part of a rating is the actual review itself. What is it saying about this wine? Maybe it got 92 points, but you probably want it's, you know, it's a Cabernet Sauvignon and you don't like bigger style red wines, or you don't want one right now. You want more like a Pinot Noir.
Uh-huh.
Sorry, I'm getting into like the little wine language now.
No,
sorry.
I mean, you're just culturing the shit out of me right now with all this wine and taking me to the School of Will and all this is going on right now.
Pardon me. Sorry.
No, it's all right. It makes sense. I mean, ratings definitely people buy go to things based on the rating that the ascribed pundits or experts.
And that's what I hate. I mean, because what makes them an expert? Why can't we question what they're saying? And honestly, when people come in and they have their big wine magazines, they think that's wine knowledge. That's not wine knowledge. Wine knowledge is actually taking the time and learning about areas, learning about grapes, learning about styles, learning about philosophy of winemaking.
Mm-hmm.
That's real knowledge when it comes to wine, not knowing name brands and the points they were given. And I don't know, I just find that people are taking the easy way and the lazy way out of acquiring this knowledge. We have a culture now of just knowing facts. We live in a Jeopardy-like culture where we know the fact, but we don't know how to connect the facts. There's no line being drawn. There's no questioning on what we're being presented.
Well, I mean, that probably goes back to failure in schooling, where it's basically all rote memorization for the most part.
Well, there's failure in schooling. There's the deregulation of major industries. And when you have a company like Sony that's making movies, toys, music, is in media, that's very disturbing. So monopolies are back. In media, there's only 6 companies that own everything in the U.S., and that's disturbing. Radio, television, movies, there's only 6 companies. In the wine industry, there's only like 5 or 6 companies in California that own all the wine.
Mm-hmm.
But people don't question that. And we gotta realize, I'm not saying that these companies are evil. They're just worried about the bottom line. And they see people as numbers and as demographics. They're heartless.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I'm not going to say.
So it's not like they're left or right. They just want to make money.
Mm-hmm.
And to have the motivation of just making money, that means you're going to step on people. That means people are going to get hurt. And I think that's wrong. So that's Will's thoughts. That's Will's coming from Will's school there.
Yeah, that is a lot of Will right there.
It is. What were we talking about, John Carter?
I have no clue what we were talking about.
Did you see Melancholia?
I did see Melancholia.
What did you think of that one?
I found it kind of hard to watch. Not boring, just not... it's not light viewing, if you will.
It's not light.
Yeah, it's no John Carter, that's for sure. I thought it was a pretty good, it's a pretty interesting character study. I agree with you that it's incredibly hard to market. I don't know how you would get anyone to go see that based on what's there in the movie, like media wise, you know, what flashiness, that sort of stuff. The typical media tricks that are used to get you into a movie.
Mm-hmm. All right. It's not a disaster movie. You can't market it on Kirsten Dunst. You can't market it on Lars von Trier. There's really no market for them. So how would you sell this? And obviously they didn't.
Yeah, exactly. Or at least they weren't successful at selling it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, I thought it was definitely interesting. I don't know. It's not something I would probably usually watch. Not saying that I would just normally watch John Carter type movies, mm-hmm. but yeah, it's not something I would go out and seek, perhaps. I don't know. I mean, it was I don't know. Do you want me to mention anything specific about? Do you have any topic that you would like to bring up in regards?
No, I just I find it I do find it interesting that you were challenged with something that's not your normal fare,
mm-hmm.
for sure. It doesn't flow like a normal story.
No.
There's a lot of excessiveness in the stylistic choices, but at the same time, I took a lot of this excess as being silly and over the top.
Yeah.
And I find that very humorous.
I don't know if that's what Lars von Trier was going for, but
it may or may not have been. Yes. And that's a problem. I think a lot of reviewers have. They try to understand the intentions of the filmmakers. We're trying, you know, we get the DVDs and we listen to the commentaries because we want to figure out what they were going for.
Yeah.
And honestly, an artist does have some input, but it's what you as the audience member get from it.
Yeah, it's what you impress upon the particular, mm-hmm.
And so I as a reviewer, when you don't have the commentary available, you can't make their intentions up, so all you can do is get what you got from it, and if it's wrong or right, who knows? It's what you felt, it's what you believe, mm-hmm. so it's right, right? That's what I would say. And honestly, I don't know what he's going for. That's what I got. I found it very humorous. Mm-hmm. Maybe he was trying to do it very seriously, but yes. I thought that it was so over the top. And the character of Kirsten Dunst was very crazy.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's Kirsten Dunst, she doesn't really strike you as someone being in an art house film.
That's true.
That coupled with you know the craziness of Lars von Trier himself.
I mean, Kiefer Sutherland was in the movie too.
And Kiefer Sutherland. Exactly. These are not two regulars from an art house film. You know, you got 24, the actor from 24, and you've got Kirsten Dunst, who was Spider-Man's girlfriend.
Yes.
So that questions, at least in my mind, what's going on. But, you know, this juxtaposition of mainstream actors in this kind of film, coupled with the excess of the stylistic choices of the repetition of that camera following them while they're riding their horses,
mm-hmm.
and the same music over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
It created a humorous effect for me.
Okay. So Will's in the art house theater just chuckling away and everyone's shushing.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Like to take films so when it's over the top like this, to take it so seriously, I think that's ridiculous. When a movie is serious, they're going to be dealing with more serious and real and mundane issues than I think this was. This was just out of, you know, I mean, there's a planet coming in collision course with Earth.
Yes.
That itself should also tell you that it's not really taking itself seriously. But, I mean, there's a lot of movies that do take themselves seriously, and you won't laugh at them. But this one, it did make me chuckle quite a lot.
Okay. I don't know if I was chuckling as much as you. In fact, I think that's probably not what happened with my viewing of it.
How many times did you pause it on your computer?
I watched it straight through.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, I don't. When I go down and sit down for a movie, I make sure that I'm ready to invest the allotted amount of time that I need to finish it. Mm-hmm. I don't like the whole stopping 15 minutes in and then, you know, coming back an hour later or whatever. That sort mm-hmm. of nonsense. So whenever I watch a movie, I make sure to finish it, start and finish it, unless, you know, there's some sort of crazy extenuating circumstances that call me away from it.
Did you get anything from the movie? Did it evoke anything?
Yeah, I mean, clearly it's filled with... I mean, my take from it, the main theme that I took from it is that... maybe not Von Trier, but the movie itself is saying that there's just... that no matter what you do or try to do, there's some things that you just can't control, and there's no point in trying to control them. And, I mean, that clearly that goes along not only with... you know, the planet hitting Earth or whatever, but also, you know, the entire first act, if you will, with Kirsten Dunst. And I thought the one line with Kiefer Sutherland when he's looking in at his kid, it kind of encapsulates the movie, where he's like, you know, he's pissed off that the wedding is going horribly. And he says something along the likes of, "I won't be mad as long as you're happy." But he's not like trying to be sympathetic or empathetic towards her. It's like he's almost forcing her, you know, he's basically forcing her to try to be happy, or else he will get pissed off. Like, it's a very threatening line that he gives. It's not supposed to be heartfelt. So I think that kind of encapsulated the movie for me. About what the main theme, I suppose, was. So, just as I'm saying something incredibly intelligent, we happen to have some technical difficulties.
I'm telling you, McDonald's doesn't like what we're saying right now, and so they are out there watching over us, and they destroyed our podcast.
They've got the bugs on the Skype conversation. You gotta love the Patriot Act. In any case,
maybe it was Burger King.
Maybe it was Wendy's, since we haven't mentioned them yet.
Oh, it could have been Wendy's.
Exactly.
Yeah, because we didn't even consider them as a choice.
Exactly. But I think I had basically finished the thought I was on about Melancholia, about how the whole movie was encapsulated in that one Kiefer Sutherland moment where you can't just make, you don't know what's going to happen, and you can't make things happen just because you want them to. So I believe that was the end of that thought, if you would like
But that's honestly, Chris, that's a great thought, and you know, the fact that you could pull something away from the movie like that, I think the movie is accomplishing something.
Well, yeah.
And it's a little bit more than robots fighting each other.
That is true. That is true.
And that's why I appreciated it so much, because it actually did have something that you could take away.
Mm-hmm.
And I like I said, I appreciated that a lot. And so stylistically, you know, the character choices, whatever, you might have some qualms with that. But I think there's a lot going on that does make you pay attention a little bit more and makes you question things a little bit more. But then you do take away something that's very important that is relevant for today. Mm-hmm. And relevant for not just today, but I think could be relevant 20, 100 years from now.
Yeah,
and
it was relevant 100.
There's a timelessness to it as well. Yeah. Exactly.
Timelessness to the message is an important thing.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to say, maybe, I don't know, for me, clearly, I think you've definitely noticed this. I think Jake, the aforementioned Jake, the other movie guy on In the Bag, has noticed this. For me, movies, I like when movies not necessarily explain things to you, but I like when they give... they put things out on the screen that allow you to understand, you know, what type of character this is and where they've come from. And I think, to me, what was hard for me, at least, especially in the first part of Melancholia, was just that we there was very little sort of background of Kirsten Dunst. So mm-hmm. I was unsure. I mean, clearly they kind of set this up. They clearly set it up in the second half, kind of.
Well,
I was kind of unsure as to if she was actually legitimately, like, manic depressed, or if she was just sad that her entire life's changing, and that's why she wasn't into the wedding and stuff. I mean, I know that's kind of like a minute detail for most people, but I think that kind of that hurt my viewing of at least the first part, since they didn't explain, like...
Well, how would you say someone's manic depressive? How do you go into someone's history? And honestly, I find a lot of movies nowadays, they feel like they have to have this exposition of all my parents are dead, and all I have is my sister. And so that makes a relationship between them and their sister. And honestly, in movies, I don't think it works, because it's a little untrue.
Well, I'm not saying that you need the exposition necessarily. I'm not saying that you need, like, the whole cookie cutter sort of, okay, well, she's going to be depressed. How does she get depressed? Okay, well, she's depressed because of A and B, you know? I'm not trying to make it like a formula where you need to, you know, depression equals...
Well, yeah, but honestly, a lot of movies are like that. You know, they would have probably put... You know, they would have showed her with, like, pills in her purse.
Mm-hmm.
And then she'd have been, oh, she's crazy because she has pills. No, I think the good movies are the ones that allow the actors, their actions and their choices to speak for themselves. And if those choices don't seem clear or logical to you, and they're very irrational, then that gives character. What they do on the screen, what you are presented by their actions, not by their words, but by their actions, not by what they wear, mm-hmm. but by their actions, is what determines their character. And it could be in contrast to what they are wearing or what they are saying, but it's always the action.
Well, yeah, no, I was just kind of confused as to if this was an isolated incident or not when I first watched the first part, is what I'm saying.
Honestly, her past, her future, you don't really care. You shouldn't. It's what you're given on screen. You make your decisions. You make your choices to that character at that time, at that moment. And it's honestly, is this a well-rounded character? No. But I don't think it needs to be. I think these are just... these are just stand-ins for ideas rather than complete characters. And sometimes in a film like this, that works.
Yeah.
Sometimes it doesn't. But for instance...
I'm just saying, you know, it took me out of the movie a little bit is all I'm saying. I'm not saying that necessarily it was like a huge deal, but, you know, I was, for at least part of the first part there, I was at least trying to figure out if this is how she normally acts or...
Mm-hmm. Well, and then that's another thing that goes all the way back to silent cinema. Eisenstein was like, there was this movement, this, you didn't want to be absorbed into films. Films needed to make people think and make people react and rise up and have action. And so when films absorb people into them, and they just start taking things for granted, and it just goes right over the head, and they're not, as you would say, they're not thinking. I think that's wrong. Some of the times, you know, honestly, this is a movie that you're not supposed to be absorbed into the picture.
Mm-hmm.
You are supposed to still, you're gonna objectify everything and look at it, at things for what they are. And you're not supposed to feel for anyone. You're not supposed to care about their choices. You just accept that those are their choices. And what is the comment on that? What do you take away from that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's what it's. This is not trying to be James Bond.
Yeah.
I'm
aware of that.
Well, see, that's good. You're aware of that.
I'm not all stupid, even though I sometimes do not say.
Oh, I'm not saying you are. No, you are. You are very smart, and that's the thing. That was my problem, because I know how smart you are, and to say John Carter was almost good. That really hurt, Chris. That really hurt.
Maybe I should have said it could have been fine. Would that have been a little better?
Well, honestly, looking back, could that movie have been fine?
I mean,
I guess yeah. if they would have actually tried with the screenwriting and gotten the story a little bit, you know, pared down, and it could have been a fine popcorn movie.
Okay.
It could have been. But honestly, the premise itself, a guy from the Civil War is going to Mars, that's a little goofy.
Yes, I would agree. Before we finish this podcast and before we get into more John Carter, which for some odd reason keeps on coming up, I wanted to mention, again, with Melancholia, specifically, I would have to say the thing that definitely stood out most for me was the sort of first 6 or 8 minute sort of overture, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, if you haven't seen the movie, it's sort of just a juxtaposition of the themes and some of the character traits in incredibly slow motion. You don't know what you're given no context really of the images that you're seeing, but they are all set to this sort of bombastic, maybe not bombastic. Bombastic might not be the right word, but
I would agree that's the right word. Bombastic, over the top score.
Yes, and so I think to me that's definitely probably going to be the thing that I remember the most about the movie. And it got me thinking as to a sort of film as a piece of art, sort of nature. It's interesting to me that film, if you consider that there are multiple forms of art other than just the visual, like, you know, painting or sculpting or anything, if you think that literature can be art and music can be art, it's interesting that film is sort of the only medium that combines all of them into one. Mm-hmm. But yet it's so, film rarely, maybe not rarely, but film often does not reach a sort of peak where some might consider it art. And so I just found that to be interesting. The first 8 minutes were very, very, very artistic. Very, you know, they really focused on the images with the music, and I thought that was really, I thought it was really cool. Even though,
mm-hmm. and then on top of that, the way the film is structured, it's like a book. Mm-hmm. He has text, you know, part one, part two, and you are right. Film is one of those. Is one of the mediums that can combine everything: photographs, art, music, acting, theater, poetry, literature. All this stuff can be put into one medium, and that's what makes it so great. It has all these different outlets, all these different things that it can do, and when you don't use them,
yeah.
What are you making? I mean, you don't have to use text all the time. You don't have to use big bombastic music or any music at all, because the absence of music could actually be saying something as well.
Very true.
But when you go into a film and you don't even have that thought process going on to begin with, if you don't even think about that, what is film and what can it do? What can I do with it? Then right away you're limited on your creativity and what you can produce.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. I mean, music, especially in film, is definitely used as a more of a emotional testosterone, if you will, emotional steroids, where, you know, you get the really intense battle, bombastic.
And that's why I appreciated the music in this, because it was very repetitive. That same score over and over again. Mm-hmm. Very emotional type of music. And this reminded me of all these melodramas that are coming out, where the music is just over the top, and it's trying to make emotions click in you, but it doesn't work because it's so staged and so phony.
Do you want to give me an example of one of these melodramas you speak of?
Melodramas. I mean, you just see it right now. For instance, I would even say Super 8 mm-hmm. is very melodramatic. The way the characters are written, the way the music plays over the characters. And it makes sense because J.J. Abrams is coming from TV and he understands. I think he's actually hit on something that's very marketable. He's getting the woman crowd because it's very melodramatic characters, almost soap opera-ish.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, he throws the big explosions and guns that gets the male crowd.
Dudes.
For the dudes. Mm-hmm. So everyone can have some fun in it. I think these movies are bad, but he's tapping into something that's working and that's making a lot of money. But that would be my example of him. You look at his shows like Lost, very melodramatic.
Mm-hmm.
Again, late night soap opera. Super 8 was just another example. These very cookie cutter relationships between the father and son and the rest of the people in the town.
Mm-hmm.
And he's crying over his lost mother. You know, I was in the theater going, get over it.
Well,
but
I'm surprised they even let you in the theaters down there anymore.
But that resonates with a lot of women. You know, the relationship that a son lost his mother and playing it over and over again and having the music over and over again and having the flashbacks over and over again, that really affects people for some reason. I don't think it's very real. Again, it's very easy and very TV-like.
Well,
why do soap operas, why are they here for 20 years? Because something about them works.
Mm-hmm. The whole cookie-cutter character thing, I mean, clearly I would prefer, you know, a very dynamic and good character, but maybe the thinking behind a rather stale, flat character is that if you give these melodramatic emotions without making a very rememberable character, it might offer up, it might allow the viewer to easier imprint themselves on the character as opposed to... Do you see what I'm saying here?
Oh, no, I do. And it depends on what are you trying to do as an artist and what are you trying to do as a filmmaker. Do you want that? Or, you know, if it... That's why it takes a lot of creativity and a lot of thinking for these movies, and I just find that there's very little going into them.
Mm-hmm. Before we go, I wanted to mention this. In today's trailer article, Trailers in the Bag, usually Jake's article, I had to finish due to some poor time management on his part, apparently. There's a movie called Snow White and the Huntsman that will be coming out this summer. And I would just like to get your take on this whole sort of a recent fad of the reimagining of classic tales or a movie such as Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, which is a genre mashup that takes something that's very known and makes it and prescribes something completely different onto it that's, you know, completely fictional.
Yep. Again, I think it just plays back to marketing. I think genres, types, was a marketing tool and term to get people into the theater. And you look at films back in the old days, you know, it's a war movie with a love story that has a little bit of comedy.
Yeah.
I like comedy, or oh, I like love stories, or oh, I like war.
Yeah.
So it's just trying to play to different demographics. And so you're getting a lot of fanboys that resonate or that are drawn to certain genres. So people like this nostalgia and historical setting.
Mm-hmm.
But then you put in vampires or zombies.
And
you
get a whole different... Yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, you got a whole new audience.
Yeah.
Cowboys and Aliens was the same thing. Attack on the Block was, I think, doing something a little bit different. That worked. But there's another example. And these genre mashups, I don't think they're anything new. They're trying to take extremes.
Well,
Abraham Lincoln, vampire killer.
Yeah. That axe is mighty powerful, though.
Yeah. So it's like... I'm trying to think. It's Mother Teresa, vampire killer, and you know, it's
delicious.
I think it's
that's
it's
a
just
movie I might see. Actually, I'm not gonna lie.
Mother Teresa, Frankenstein, monster maker.
Mother Teresa Stein.
Mother Teresa Stein. And so, you know, cowboys and aliens, two completely different genres and two types that we have been so bogged down in cliche that it's ridiculous. But now they can't think of any more cliches. So
they put two together.
Let's put them together. Maybe something good will come out.
Well, I want you to comment on the whole reimagining of the classic tale as well. If you find that there's any sort of, I mean, clearly that these movies aren't going to go away. You know, the Cinderellas and the Snow Whites. There's always going to be different iterations in them.
The other one is Maleficent that's coming out. I think that's the take on Sleeping Beauty's nemesis.
Okay.
From her perspective, her story.
Well, I mean, that's a. I think that might be a little different than, say, what Snow White and the Huntsman's trying to do.
I don't even know what that one's trying to do. I haven't seen the trailer. What is that
one? It's basically just... I mean, the trailer looks like an action movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's clearly marketing and guided towards, you know, teens and young men, if you will, looking mm-hmm. for some awesome action and some special effects. You know, it's not your typical Snow White. It's not a realistic version. It's not like, you know, it's not like it's set in the modern day, or it's not like, well, maybe this actually did happen. You know, it's not like the Arthur movie that starred Clive Owen from early in 2000s. That was supposed to be a, well, maybe he was real, and if he was, this is how it might look, sort of thing. It's more just, okay, well, it's Snow White, but we're going to make it bigger than Snow White. We're going to
amp it up.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you know, usually Snow White, usually fairy tales in general, aren't that action-packed. So I was wondering just what's your take on the whole sort of reimagining of...
Well, I think
It's very like... Snow White. It's much like Alice in Wonderland.
I think what they're doing is they're using the story as a crutch because it's been tried... And it's true mm-hmm. that people understand the story and they get it. So they don't want to deal with that creativity, or what am I trying to say? They don't want to think about that uh-huh. in the writing process because they already have the story.
Yeah.
What they want to do is they just want to pump it full of spectacle because that's easy.
Yes, it is.
And they're going to sell it.
So I'm assuming you don't like that. Particular.
Honestly, I mean, you see what they're doing. It's obvious.
Yeah.
Does it mean it's going to work or not work? I don't know. But at least the motivations right off the bat, I do not like.
Okay. Yeah.
And when you're making something to just make money, that's very dishonest.
That is also true. But okay, I think that's probably going to end it for the podcast today.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully next time
I won't be so angry.
Well, no, I mean, I'm thinking about, I'm toying with the idea of just making the name of this podcast 60 Minutes of Hate with Will Templin.
And that's the thing, I don't hate
everything. I'm just kidding. But
sometimes you do need McDonald's.
That's true. I think I had Jack in the Box for supper the other day just because.
Oh, no.
I was hungry and I didn't want to cook anything. So there you go.
Oh.
And it was like 10 o'clock at night. In any case.
Oh. What are you eating? So what are you eating dinner so late at night?
Well, I believe we just discussed that I woke up at 12 o'clock today. So that usually means that I'm staying up late at night. So my schedule is a little shifted, if you will.
Oh. Oh.
Yes.
So right now it's breakfast for you?
Pretty much. In any case, what I was going to say was hopefully we can have Will on for some more podcasts. Hopefully next time I have Will on, I sound a little bit more intelligent.
No, you were good.
Than I do. Hopefully I'll be able to hold a candle next to the maelstrom that is Will Templin next time. But
I noticed too, you have like, you have your name, Bags, and then there's like Joe Dog and Jimmy TV. Do Jake and I get any names?
Well, they actually came up with their own names. My author name is Chris Pagano.
Mine is W. Templin.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. The reason why I say Bags is just so people realize that, like, Chris Pagano is Bags, and the website is In the Bag.
And W. Templin is Will. I get you. Okay.
Yeah, so that's I'm just trying to make sure that, like, people understand that most of the viewpoints are mine, and that the Bag is Chris Pagano, is basically what I'm doing.
Oh.
If you want a nickname, we could always come up with one.
About Templinstein.
we could come up with, yeah, we could do that. I mean, I don't know if that really improves on what we have now, but yeah, you could always come up with a nickname if you really wanted one.
No, I don't want a nickname. I was just teasing.
Yeah, no, I mean, I have no clue why Jimmy TV, why the other Jake calls himself Jimmy TV before we had movie Jake on, Jay Krengel. I don't know why he decided with Jimmy TV, but maybe they're just not, they're trying to hide the fact that they actually are a part of this website. I'm not quite sure. In any case,
you can call me Kate from now on.
I don't think that's going to
happen. I'll be known as Kate.
I don't think I'll have you on the podcast then if that's what we're going with. That would be really weird. In any case,
I could just be a smoker.
Okay, well, we can discuss this later.
Kate the Smoker.
Please come by the website, in-the-bag2gs.com. We try to update it multiple times a day. Will, in fact, has his weekly article on the Criterion Collection movies coming out tomorrow. So you can come and check out that if you really enjoy Will and reading what he has to say or listening to what he has to say. And other than that, we'll probably come back at you guys a little later in the week. Later.